I'm dreaming of a white Xmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in snow. I'm dreaming of a white Xmas with every Xmas card I write. May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Xmases be white. May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Xmases be white.
Hello, believers or not, this is still Julian Charles of themindrenewed.com, still podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 27th of November 2012, and it's great to have with me over the internet the performer of that seasonal offering, all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, the world capital of country music, Mr. John Jones, aka JJ Jones, singer, activist, and performance artist extraordinaire. So, JJ, welcome to The Mind Renewed. It's good to have you on.
Greetings, Julian. I'm very happy to be talking to you today.
Thanks for sparing the time to come on. I was keen to have you on the podcast because I heard you, I think it was last year, on Corbett Report Radio, and a number of the songs were being played. And I have to say, they really caught my imagination because I thought that not only were they entertaining, you know, great singing, great production quality, plenty of ironic humor, but through all of that, you were making some important political and indeed spiritual points. And all of that really appealed to me. So I went to your website, jjjones.de, and I was amazed by the eclectic mix of music projects that you're involved in. Just to give people an idea, you're involved in film music, country music, political parody, spiritual improvisations. You've got a medley of German pop, Dick Zeppelin, the rockabillyization of Led Zeppelin, and your good self as the human snow globe, which I hope to ask you about a bit later on. So I guess the first question has got to be, who is JJ Jones? Is there any way of defining who you are and what you do?
Oh, that would be something I would never want to do. I think that you've basically alluded to what I like to think of myself as, someone who plays the broad spectrum, and I like to be open to all possibilities. So I'm very disinterested in labeling myself or figuring out my market niche. It's just never been interesting to me.
Would you define yourself as an artist?
The first thing that pops into my head in general is that if I were to define myself in any way, I've always been comfortable with the label of truth seeker. Mm-hmm. And I find that can be applied to the arts as well as to the spirituality that I pursue. For me, the beauty about my music projects is that I really love each and every one of them, and they're very honest. I can't really find motivation to do something that's not really truly wanting to come out of me. And when something wants to get out, I do let it out. But it's often things seem very at odds. For example, there's a lot of people who don't understand why, as a spiritual Christian motivated musician, that I would engage in other kinds of silliness like the human snow globe, or, you know, Ron Paul songs of being politically active in some kind of bizarre way. That's, for some people, that doesn't work together. But for a lot of people, they do understand the desire to just do different things.
So a lot of people feel that you should be just a musician, just be a singer, and that makes sense to them.
I wouldn't say that I have many people who've told me you should just do one thing. In fact, I don't think I've ever heard that. But there is a, you know, in today's marketing world, market-driven world, there is this weird magnetism toward clearly defining yourself and having some very definable product. And I've generally not really resisted it as much as just ignored it.
Mm. What you do, though, is always centered in the musical, isn't it? It's as far as I can see, you're nearly always singing.
Yes.
Have you always been interested in music? Is that something that goes back to your childhood?
Absolutely. Yes, I was singing. My first recollections are singing in the living room for my parents, some Michael Jackson or some Jackson 5 songs. And I was about 5 years old, and my father used to take me to Kmart on a regular basis, and we'd get 2 45s for a dollar. And that was one of the highlights of my childhood, is getting 45s and coming home and playing them on my little record player.
And did you do the moves as well?
I was never much of a dancer. I do like to jump around, but I was never much of a dancer.
I noticed on your website that you're based in Nashville, but it also says Munich. I know that you have a history of performances in Berlin. How come that you have this German connection?
Oh, well, it's interesting because the architecture school where I went back in the 80s, that was my first real course of study. And at some point or another, I found myself in an internship at a television studio with one of the teachers at my architecture school. And I got that bug, and I decided to shift my major to something else. But in that process, I decided I should take a foreign language. And the only foreign language that was offered at this architecture school was German, because it was also an engineering school. And really, you know, to make a kind of a long story short, I just sort of stuck with German. And by the time I graduated from film school from the University of Michigan, I had stuck with German. And then when I traveled to Europe, I almost didn't even go to Germany, because I really didn't care about Germany so much as I cared about France and the South, where it was warmer, because I was traveling in September and October. And I just kind of was convinced by a philosophy professor with whom I was doing a video project. He said, go to this little tiny town, and it still has a wall around it, and you can speak some German, and you got to go visit, and I know some people there, and you'll have a place to stay. And I said, okay. And I ended up staying there for a couple of extra months, teaching English and painting murals, and I met my wife.
And while you were in Germany, did you found or you got involved with a band called Fuzzy Love? Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that started when I was working on a film festival, and this wonderful group of artists from Canada, Laura Kakauka and Gordon Monahan. Laura had an art project, which was an installation called Spätverkauf, which means late night shopping. And in Germany, there are, I don't know if you're familiar, probably the same in Britain, but there are places, special places that are allowed to stay open late.
Uh-huh.
She turned this old little pavilion into basically a late night bar, but it was full of all of her kitschy installations, and she was into maximalism. And her husband, Gordon, played the organ, the home console organ there as background music, and he invited people to sing. So it was basically live karaoke. And I did that for several years before it became really regular, and we decided that we were actually a band.
Right.
Then we got a name, and the Spätverkauf became Schmalzwald, another two different incarnations of that art installation, before we stopped doing the bar art installation and started just being a band all the time.
And where did the name Fuzzy Love come from?
Fuzzy Love is a title of an album, and I've long forgotten who the artist was, but it's the name of an album. I think it's a Canadian artist, and I think it's mostly spoken word.
Uh-huh.
There's like a sheepdog on the cover. and it's quite funny stuff. But the name Fuzzy Love, this record was in Gordon and Laura's collection, and I guess one day he ran across it and realized it was a perfect name for a band, and I immediately loved it myself, so we were happy to call ourselves Fuzzy Love.
Well, I followed through the links on your website to Fuzzy Love, and you've got quite a selection of songs that you've put up on the, I think it's on SoundCloud.com.
Yes,
and there's one that really stuck in my mind and really appealed to me was your homage to David Bowie.
Yes.
Your cover version of Ziggy Stardust. Why did you decide to do that?
We basically considered ourselves a cover band of all the greatest hits of all time. And being mostly from the 60s and 70s, it's kind of hard not to love David Bowie if you're an artist. And would really just try out everything. We'd go through these fake books and just play everything. You know, eventually you'd find the songs that you liked to sing better than others and the ones that were easier to play. And that was one of the ones that we ended up liking a lot.
Well, we're going to hear it now, actually, but I must just say before anybody listens to this, there's a very, I'm going to ask you about this later, but there's a very strange noise that goes on throughout a number of these songs. I don't know what it is. I'll ask you in a minute. We're going to hear. I really don't know what it is. I know what the organ is, but the other one that just goes, well, I'll demonstrate. It's sort of, I haven't got a clue what that is.
Yeah, it's a.
That's it. You'll have to tell me in a minute. We're going to hear Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie, but this time performed by J.J. Jones.
And Fuzzy Love.
We do. We have a couple of favorite David Bowie songs. This wasn't the one I was thinking of, but I like it just as much.
I think a lot of people have a couple of favorite David Bowie songs.
Jamming good with Weird and Gilly in the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand and made it too far. Became the special man, and we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang. Screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. Came on so loaded, well hung in snow white tan. Played for time, jiving us that we were voodoo. The kid was just crass, he was an ass with God-given ass. But he took it all too far, but boy could he play guitar. Making love to his ego, and Ziggy sucked up into his mind like a leper messiah. The kids who killed his hands, now should we Thank you.
Dankeschön.
Oh boy.
I guess that brings back memories.
It does. It does. That was a weird. It actually sounds better than I recall. I remember feeling that whole night as we were recording this live CD that I couldn't really hear myself and I wasn't really on key and the pitches were off, but it actually didn't sound so bad.
It sounded great to me. You got to tell me, though, what that instrument is.
That is called a theremin, and it was invented by a man named Leon Theremin. He was a brilliant Russian scientist, and it can be played brilliantly by very few people, but when it's done properly, it sounds so ethereal. It sounds like a hyper-ethereal violin. It's basically two antenna, so you don't even touch the instrument. It's proximity and radio signals, and one of the antenna controls the volume and one controls the pitch. And so your hands are always moving back and forth. In fact, you've got to move your pinky finger to get differences in pitch sometimes.
So there's a kind of performance art aspect to that as well, then, a bit of theatricality to it.
Absolutely. And the man who played that, Gordon W., was a performance art cook, and he was our percussionist and theremin player, and he had a great presence, and he really knew how to squeeze the theremin for everything it was worth.
Because on your website, you describe yourself as a singer and an activist, but also as a performance artist. And I don't know, but I guess a few people probably won't really be familiar with that term. I mean, the only people that I know of who are performance artists here in the UK are Gilbert and George. But over in the States, I don't think I can think of anybody, apart from yourself, of course, except the late, great Andy Kaufman, who I know a lot of people would think of as a comedian, but so far as I understand, he said he was a performance artist. Why do you describe yourself as a performance artist, then?
Well, I'm so glad that you can think of Andy Kaufman, because he really is one of the greatest performance artists that I know of.
Yeah.
And I won't say that he motivates me, but I think subconsciously he and Steve Martin had a certain kind of sense of humor. Steve Martin definitely motivates my sense of humor, because I basically studied his Wild and Crazy Guy albums from the time I was in seventh grade till through high school. I used to recite it for my parents' friends at parties. And I didn't discover Andy Kaufman until later. In fact, I think it was really, we went to go see the movie Man on the Moon while we were performing in Paris with Fuzzy Love, and we all went to go see this film, and I realized then how really similar what we were doing was. Just the kind of irony that we were playing with. I remember seeing Saturday Night Live when he did the, "Here I come to save the day." And I remember, you know, with a record player, he played it and he just stood there and he did nothing except mime to, "Here I come to save the day." And I remember then thinking, wow, this is really, really cool. I really love this.
It's incredible. Such a simple idea and amazingly effective.
Exactly. And I go for that simplicity. In fact, I'd say like one of my, I love the fact that I was able to parodize a Christmas song by changing one syllable in the song, White Xmas. And that's the kind of simplicity that I go for. But in terms of being a performance artist, it's really, I've never decided on a definition of that. But essentially, it's a very personal kind of theater. A performance artist generally is a person or a couple of people who present themselves in a slightly theatrical way. And I think it has to be slight, because once you take on a character, it's not really performance art anymore. It's acting. It's theater, which that's fine. And I've done theater and I love to do theater. But for me, performance art is presenting a sort of version of myself and tweaking it somehow and putting myself in a situation, sometimes a costume, sometimes a space that's telling some kind of a story or something's going on in that space or in that costume. And it's kind of related to me, but you don't really know. And there's always some sort of a tension between the person and what's going on. And if that is some sort of vague definition of performance art, that's what I offer.
And in that tension, are you trying to change the perception of your audience in any way? I mean, again, I'm thinking of Andy Kaufman. I mean, he was very, well, not exactly wicked, you know, but, you know, he wasn't kind to his audience always, was he? But he was trying to get them to realize their own prejudices and the like, wasn't he? Do you try to do that as well?
I definitely try to do that. I think it is important, at least for my performance art, that the audience has to ask themselves who I am and why I'm there. One of the greatest things that anyone ever asked us when we were doing Fuzzy Love, periodically someone would come up and to me and say, "Are you serious?" Because they really didn't know. And I just thought that that was wonderful. I thought it was so wonderful that we were able to hold that tension that, you know, some people thought we were just some silly cover band, which we were, but we were also more than that.
Sure. I actually want to ask you about that sort of philosophy of comedy a little later on, but not to leave this question of performance art here. When I went onto YouTube, I saw you performing as the human snow globe, and it shows you clothed in a warm fur coat, and you're in this huge plastic bubble with fake snow, and you're in the middle of the desert, and you're singing your own kind of Mexican-German version of Winter Wonderland, one of the songs off your Christmas album. What's going on there? What's that all about? The human snow globe.
Well, it's essentially the human snow globe was an effort because I came to Nashville after living in Berlin for 10 years, and I decided actually to pursue my spiritual education. But there was really only one place I wanted to go in the United States because Nashville was such a perfect connection between, I always say, God, music, and the weather. And it was the only place in the United States I had any interest in being, and it's been a great place to live. But when I arrived here, I realized I don't care about country music. I don't know anything about it. I don't play an instrument. And it was near Christmas time. I arrived here in October, and Christmas was coming, and I thought, wow, I recorded this Christmas album, and I really love it, and it's fresh, and I'd love to perform it, but I can't just do karaoke. As much as I like the songs, I think they do stand on their own when you're listening to them, but I don't think I want to see myself singing karaoke. So I had to come up with some way of presenting these songs, and it really quickly came to me out of nowhere. Honestly, it was just a zap of inspiration that I could find a big bubble and do a human snow globe thing. Of course, I thought perhaps there would be oxygen issues and that kind of thing, but I quickly found this globe, and it was a, you know, water sport toy, and I got the fake snow out of, from Hollywood, and I had the greatest coat. I was so happy, and I was really happy with the whole costume, and it became for me such a wonderful and perfect art piece. I'm still so happy with it. It works perfectly, and I'm so pleased to be able to present it to people. And it's a rare thing when, as an artist, to have something that you really are truly satisfied with.
But not a comfortable experience to do, I shouldn't think, in that heat.
No. Well, of course, I challenged myself even more in that video because I wanted to do a video of the human snow globe, and it was hard for me to come up with the situation. And I never wanted to fall into that trap of, you know, the 70s K-Tel, you know, cheesy music commercial on TV, which a lot of people were doing. I really wanted it to be just as odd, the video to be as odd as the performance. itself, and I think we did achieve that, although I wish we'd had time to shoot more footage and have a few more different camera angles. But I think Turtle O'Toole, the cinematographer from New Mexico, did manage to do quite a good job with it.
Okay, well, let's hear a little bit of it then. So this is you as the human snow globe, Winter Wonderland in the middle of the desert.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird. Here to stay is the new bird. He sings a love song as we go along. Laufen durch ein Winter Wonderland. Auf der Heide bauen wir ne Schneemann und tun, als ob der ist Pfarrer Braun. Fragt uns, ob wir wollen uns heiraten. Wir lachten und dann sind wir abgehauen. Later on we'll conspire as we dream by the fire. To face unafraid the plans that we've made. Laufen durch ein Winterwunderland. Santa Claus. Auf der Heide bauen wir den Schneemann
Ubuntu, Nassau Day ist ein Circus Clown. Wir haben super Spaß mit Mr. Schneemann, bis die Alligator schmeißt ihn runter. When it snows, ain't it thrilling? Obwohl die Nase gets a chilling. We spielen, we play the Eskimo way, laufen durch ein Winter Wonderland. Walking in a winter wonderland. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Well, one of the things I wanted to say about those Christmas songs that I can't not say is one of the things that works so well for me about the project is that I was lucky to finally find, after a lot of research into finding music to sing on top of, that I finally came across the album Mele Kalikimaka by Arthur Lyman Orchestra, which was recorded in 1949 in Hawaii and has these gorgeous arrangements that allowed me to sing on top of them, because all the other music that I found was full of horns and children's choirs, and if it was instrumental, it was just so dense that I couldn't really sing on top of it. And I was just so happy to find this music, because it lends the certain je ne sais quoi that I wouldn't have if I'd had it produced, you know, re-recorded by musicians. It has that magical quality about it. And people sometimes ask, like, where does that music from?
Yeah, and it allows you to do that. Is it number 4 on that album, Mary's Boy Child?
That's right.
Yeah, and it allows that delicacy there, doesn't it? It's very suitable.
Exactly, yeah.
On one of your websites, you have a strap line for these Christmas songs, and it says 12 minutes of Christmas, putting the X back into Christmas, which I thought was a really inspired line. And that is prompting me, of course, to ask you about your Christian faith. And I've got a couple of questions about this. First of all, how did you actually become a believer in Jesus Christ? And secondly, how does that faith connect with your art?
Well, I became a believer in Jesus Christ in the best possible way for me, which was through singing. It really happened over the course of a couple of years singing in a Serbian Orthodox church choir in Berlin. I found myself going back to church after having a difficult period in my life around the same time when I left Fuzzy Love. Life was very challenging, and I decided to start going to church, and I started going to a kind of a typical Protestant church where I was close to where I was living. And one day I arrived at church like an hour early, and I think either I'd been on tour and I came back and I was off, or I'd forgotten the time, or maybe it was even a daylight savings issue, but I found myself an hour early for church. And I didn't want to wait to go to church. I just wanted to go to church. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to listen to the bells. I'm in a big city and there are bells. I hear them. I'll just go find whatever church that is and go to there. And I walked into this church that I'd found by listening to the bells. And there was this gorgeous choir singing. And I knew I would want to sing in that choir. And I did. And they took me in. And I was the only American amongst a bunch of Serbians. And it wasn't long after the war, and literally some of them thought I was a spy. But in the process of singing these magnificent Russian Orthodox hymns, mostly written by Stefan Mokranjac, I honestly became to understand the metaphysical reality of Jesus Christ and God. I mean, the whole metaphysical reality became tangible for me. Mm-hmm. And that's when that happened.
So that's through the music itself.
Yes. And for me, it's also so magical because I was singing in Slavonic, which is a language I don't understand. So it was really the act of the pure singing for God in a spiritual environment, and just the beauty of those songs and the beauty of the melodies, and singing with a relatively big choir. I'd say we had at least 10 people in each voice, so up to 40 people singing at one time, and just being overwhelmed by the beauty of it. And then slowly, literally, being able to physically understand the tangible reality of the metaphysical existence of Christ.
What you say there actually reminds me slightly of the French composer Olivier Messiaen, in some of the music that he wrote, where he was trying to capture the eternal. And what a lot of what he did, he would use repetition, mm-hmm. as if to give this sense that the music itself was never changing. It was speaking of the impassibility of God or the eternality of God. And was it those sorts of qualities in the music, perhaps, that was giving rise to that effect?
Yeah, I think so. Right. I mean, one of the thing when you're singing in the Russian, in the Orthodox choir, is you're constantly singing variations of Gospodi pomiluj, which means Lord have mercy. and you're just singing it over and over and over and over again in different simple melodies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is hypnotic, although I don't like to use that word
sure,
because there are
yeah.
negative connotations, but it does put one into a different state that's more open to the metaphysical reality.
Yeah, it helps, opens you up to truths that you wouldn't otherwise consider.
Exactly. It surpasses the intellect is the way I like to express it.
How does this faith that you have in God and Jesus now connect with your art?
It's given me new standards to judge things by. I went through a period where I felt like I had to only sing things that were obviously spiritually oriented. And I created a project called Ecclesiaudio, which is a group of people who do mostly improvised music, but I wasn't exclusively improvising at that time. I just wanted a group of eclectic musicians and any other kind of sound artists to come together and do very, very wide spectrum of approaches to communicating spirit and gratitude and just something spiritual in the music without having it be specifically contemporary Christian music, for example, which is very prevalent in Nashville and which I don't really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
And also, you know, I spend a lot of time and still do singing in a local Serbian Orthodox choir, and I sing solos in Christian Science churches.
Uh-huh.
And I spend a lot of time writing these songs. So, yeah, I mean, since then I've spent much more time making specifically spiritual music. But of course, I've also continued to do the Human Snow Globe and to look for other projects that are just fun, basically.
And does it connect with your activism in any way?
Absolutely, because I'm discerning things in a different way. I mean, for me, the reason why I could become remotely political, such as with the Ron Paul songs, was because I saw Congressman Paul as a truly good example of a Christian person trying to help humanity solve its problems. And based on the standards that I've learned, just the simplest things, I mean, the golden rule and selflessness. And, you know, I saw a person who seemed to be, based on all of the evidence, an incredibly honest person. And so I felt compelled to support this candidacy of his. And so it just really, for me, it was easy. And I'm not otherwise involved in politics. And frankly, I don't know that I ever will be again. But in this particular instance, I just felt that this person was so compelling that I had to use my special talents to help him.
Well, I want to ask you a few more questions about your activism in a couple of minutes. But before I do that, let's just hear something of the character of your work in this area with your reworking of Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. And you've entitled it End the Fed, in the spirit of Johnny Cash.
Watch on your government. You can be sure those boys weren't heaven sent. Behind closed doors they're printing money all hell bent. If I weren't dead, I'd end the Fed. For easy money they've got quite an appetite. Their printing presses are running day and night, all while the price of gold is going out of sight. If I weren't dead, I'd end the Fed. Oh, I sure wish I could too. Low rates of interest are just a cruel joke. How can you get a loan when all you got is broke? You watch your whole life savings going up in smoke. If I weren't dead, I'd end the Fed. And you know I would too, if I wasn't up here all dressed in white and learning how to play the harp. I find it very, very easy to be true. As an angel, I cannot lie to you, relaying me.
messages is all that I can do now. Get it through your head. You gotta end that Fed. I wish I could help, but it's all up to you. So pull yourselves up by the bootstraps and get out there. And a little word to the wise, I'd keep a close watch on your government. Your grandkids' money has nearly all been spent. Taxing the rich folks will barely make a dent. If I weren't dead, I'd end the Fed. That's right, if I weren't up here in heaven, I'd sure as hell come down there and end that Fed!
Wow, that was a really great song. Did I do that?
You certainly did.
Wow, I haven't heard that one in a while, but that's really good.
I expect that many listeners will recognize that call, End the Fed, as coming from Dr. Ron Paul, who campaigned, of course, for the Republican Party nomination for the U.S. election. And his call was to end the Federal Reserve, which I understand he claims is dangerous to the U.S. economy and that it's fundamentally corrupt as well. What's your take on this criticism of the Federal Reserve?
Well, just to clarify for Dr. Paul, he never really meant to completely end the Fed immediately, although his book was called End the Fed, and it's easier to remember. It's just a great statement, End the Fed, and it looks good on paper as well. But I mean, of course, phase it out. But the reality is, I believe, and it makes perfect sense to me, and also in terms of the spirituality and the discernment of the notion that some secret group of people can randomly decide to print money and basically give it to their friends, who are the bankers, that it will somehow trickle down. This whole notion to me seems fundamentally corrupt.
Yeah.
And I just think it's wrong. We have to have a better way of, there has to be better monetary policy. And for years and years, I was sort of struggled with this question without ever having done a whole lot of research. I never spent a lot of time really doing the research, but finally when Dr. Paul came along, it just seemed so obvious and clear why I never understood economics, because it never made sense, because it doesn't make sense for some office to be printing a bunch of money and giving it out. It just doesn't make any sense.
And by the time that money trickles down, as you say, to the ordinary people on the street, it's getting to be pretty much worthless.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the whole business of inflation and how complicated that is. I just think there needs to be more transparency so that people really know, really have a much more realistic sense of how much money is really in the economy. And I think we just don't know that because all these are secret deals behind closed doors. And I think it takes such a long time for the inflation to kick in that you can never trace it back specifically, so there's no accountability.
A lot of people say that we're all just waiting really for this time bomb to go off.
Well, it's already happened a few times. I mean, it was so obvious with the stock market crash and with the housing bubble, and this is just another bubble, and everyone knows that there's a bond market bubble. And to be honest, I understand these things very superficially, but what I do understand is so clear and simple about the principle of the whole approach that I'm confident in supporting certain arguments that I might not be able to debate experts about for hours.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Now, Ron Paul describes himself as a libertarian. Would you describe yourself in the same way?
I think so. Yes, I think it's a good, I think there are other labels, minarchist or minarchist or whatever. It's funny because I have been telling people recently, I'm a local socialist, a national libertarian, and an international anarchist, probably more like a minarchist. But
could you explain all those terms?
Well, you know, locally speaking, if you've got a small, you know, in your city or in your county or even in your state, when I'm speaking of the United States, of course, but in your region, right? Of course, you want to do whatever you can to take care of everybody, which is a completely socialistic kind of a mindset. And any rational person would want that to be true. And of course, there are going to be people who, you know, would rather teach a man to fish than give him the fish. And, you know, some people you need to teach and some people you need to give, depending on the time. But in a small, in a smaller regional kind of way, I think it's much easier to have an overview of that and to control it. But the higher you go, the farther removed the people making the decisions are, and the more power they have. And then on the national level, it's crazy. I mean, you've got an army and an IRS forcing people to pay taxes, and then they do these crazy things with the money, like war and a bunch of others that benefits the rich. I have nothing against the rich, but, you know, as long as they earn their money, but they shouldn't be given government handouts. The farther removed you are, it's much easier for the national government of the United States to create a welfare state and to say, oh, look, we're helping people. But then what they end up doing is trapping these people in the welfare state. But they can't feel it because they're too far away or they're too far removed. So locally, I'm totally into socialism. Let's help everybody and let's share the wealth and let's be good Christians. On a national level, you've got to reduce the power that's in those hands. Absolutely. And certainly a world government. We're nowhere near being ready for a world government. Even believe that people even talk about it. I mean, look how different all of the continents are. How could you ever have a world government?
And yet people do talk about it. And it's quite incredible to me that anybody could think that that would work.
Yeah. It's so counterintuitive that it's mind-boggling.
Mm. One of your most well-known songs for the Ron Paul campaign was the Downtown song. Was that actually your most well-known one, would you say?
Unfortunately, I didn't have such great success or broad success. I'm just trying to think of how it was received locally. It did seem to come out at a good time. No. The best received one wasn't a directly Ron Paul song, but it was part of the series, and it was The Grinch. It was the Newt Gingrich song, You're the Wrong One, Mr. Gingrich. And I just happened to have really good timing with that one at the Christmas season. And it went sort of viral on YouTube. Not viral, but a lot of, you know, several thousand people listened to it and liked it a lot. But Downtown was the first song that I did. And I felt like it was, for me, the most successful because it really explained things. And I think it had a great jingle to it. You know, Ron Paul. It was just a song that I was desperate to record because once I got the idea for it, I just thought it was so good that I had to do it. And it was the only song that I paid to have reproduced. So it was re-recorded all from scratch in a studio here in Nashville. The other songs I used karaoke tracks for.
Well, this one particularly appealed to me because of the lyrics. I thought you got those absolutely perfect. So here is JJ Jones with a performance that I think overshadows that of Petula Clark, the Downtown song.
When it's time to elect a president who'll protect your precious liberty, vote Ron Paul. When you're uncertain, the economy's hurting, and the dollar's weak, vote Ron Paul. We all love Obama, but he's really just the same as every other candidate who promised he would change. Aren't we still at war? Let's bring all the troops back home. And as for sovereign nations, let's leave them alone and vote Ron Paul. He's really not that old. Ron Paul, he'd rather pay with gold. Ron Paul, America really needs you. Ron Paul. Don't get confused when silly people misuse the word conservative with Ron Paul. He's totally hip and lots of liberals flip in the affirmative for Ron Paul. Sure, he's a Republican, but don't let labels fool ya. His whole philosophy is not to let the government rule ya. Now that's liberal. Return to the Constitution. OMG, that's not short of a revolution. For Ron Paul, he'll open up the Fed. Ron Paul, drinking raw milk in bed. Ron Paul, everyone's rooting for you. Ron Paul. Ron Paul. By showing the whole world how we can prosper and not trample on basic freedoms. He'll march through those DC gates, wrestle the power from Sam and give it back to the states. Let's vote Ron Paul. Get your butt off the chair, Ron Paul. It's time to prove you care, Ron Paul. Wants you to keep your cash, Ron Paul. Doesn't care if you're smoking hash, Ron Paul. Slashing the income tax, Ron Paul. Wielding the budget act, Ron Paul. He's done his part, now do yours.
Now, there's one issue that came out in that last song about drinking raw milk in bed.
Yes.
I know that issue got under your skin as somebody with libertarian sensibilities, this whole business of many states in the U.S. restricting the sale of raw milk because the FDA claims it's necessary for health reasons. This led you to write another song, didn't it? Can you tell us something about this issue and why you felt so strongly about it that you actually created a song about it?
Well, it's a great example of how Ron Paul is able to identify the essence of things. And I think the raw milk issue is an extraordinary one because it's the most simple, basic aspect of human nutrition. You know, children are given milk. Babies, you know, either their mother's milk or some other animal, usually a cow's milk. And so it's so essential to the human survival. And for the government to restrict a person from choosing to give this nutritious, this incredibly nutritious milk to one's child or to oneself because it might be contaminated, because someone might not have treated it properly, to me is just the quintessential issue of overreaching government control, trying to tell us what's good for us. And I personally have long been someone very interested in nutrition. Many years ago, I read a study about how cats fed raw milk versus pasteurized milk became infertile. The ones drinking pasteurized milk became infertile within a certain number of generations. So I was always leery of dairy products, pasteurized dairy products, and basically avoided them for the most part for many years. So then when I realized, when the thing clicked together about not having access to raw milk because it's protected by the government, I just thought, wow, this is really, really crazy. And I think I started writing that song the day that I went to an Amish farm here in Tennessee and bought myself some raw milk. I wouldn't say it was that much more amazing than a decent brand of good old milk, but it really was better. There's no question about it.
And hasn't the government been very heavy-handed about it as well?
Sure. I can't give you so many specific examples, but people have definitely been fined and, you know, people's businesses have been shut down for selling raw milk. And, you know, there's no question that it needs maybe a warning label, you know, or something. Or I wouldn't even mind if people had to sign a waiver when they bought it, but it certainly shouldn't be illegal. There's no question about that.
Yeah, it's very much an example of what we call over here the nanny state taking care of us all.
I mean, it's good to have watchdogs. There's nothing wrong with having organizations that are watching out for us. But I think when you start regulating basic human necessities like that, it's not good. And, you know, on one hand, they're regulating raw milk. On the other hand, they're completely allowing the genetic manipulation of corn. It's the simplest things. They're allowing the genetic manipulation of corn, but they won't allow raw milk to be sold. To me, that's so unbelievably inconsistent that it just throws me into a fit.
Absolutely. Before we go to the next song, which is in fact called Raw Milk, which like many of your performances uses a lot of comedy, I actually wanted to ask you a bit more about this comedic element in your work. A long time I've been fascinated by the idea of comedy as one of the tools of the artist. And I think that very often comedy is seen as something less than real art. I think it's seen as something like, if comedy is not serious, then it cannot be about anything serious, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
Also, I think that it's sometimes seen as more of a craft, you know, like the craft of the stand-up comedian, but not really art at all. But I see it as one of the colors in the artist's palette, you know, whatever form you're dealing with, I think it can be very, very effective. What's your take on this? How do you see your use of comedy in your art?
Well, I think there's a difference between comedy and irony and absurdity. I think a lot of comedy is enjoyable but very base. For example, there's a lot of comedy based on bodily functions. Yeah. And sex and this kind of stuff. And it makes people laugh because they're uncomfortable.
Sure.
And so there's a lot of comedy that involves that. But for me, more refined sensibility of absurdity and irony is what I find to be artful. Anything that's truly artful anyway is deeply inspired and meaningful. And I do believe that tickling those uncomfortable places can help us to see things more clearly. And, you know, I think that the comedians, for example, like Richard Pryor, a lot of the early black comedians who were, even Don Rickles, you know, making fun of other social groups, cultural groups, in an artful way, using irony and absurdity, really probably, most certainly helped bring us more together and be more comfortable with each other. I like to use absurdity and irony in order to just make people think.
Sure.
Don't take things on face value. Just think about it.
Well, this next song certainly does that. There's plenty of absurdity and irony in this. So this is Raw Milk. This time it's in the spirit, not of Johnny Cash, but the spirit of Frankie Lane.
From them teats is flowing nectar straight from heaven, raw milk. You don't know what you're missing. It's delicious, pure nutrition. You'd be crying if you ever let it spill. But it's too healthy when it's raw, so they passed a stupid law. You'd think the stuff came from a moonshine still. Drink it up, yum, if you can get it. Oh, where can I find raw milk? Bribe a farmer. Code word Daisy Juice.
Daisy Juice.
Don't get caught with raw milk. Rolling, rolling, rolling. Our freedom has been stolen. Big dairy's still bankrolling raw milk. Their lactose intoleration has compromised the nation. Will they ever be prepared to foot the bill? When will it be okay for us Americans to say what we put between our lips is our free will? Drink it up.
Hey.
It's your right.
Yes, sir.
Chug it down. Raw milk. French chemist.
Olé.
Don't know everything. Oh. Love a cow. Let's all drink raw milk. Hold it right there, you dirty farmer. I'm with the FDA. What you got?
Why, that's the white devil juice if I ever saw it. Disgusting.
That stuff right there is downright unpasteurized. Now dump it out.
No!
Tip it over.
No!
Spill it now.
No!
It's raw milk. Tie up those heifers.
No!
Slap these stickers on their udders. You can't drink raw milk.
Give me that.
Wow, once again, it's been so long since I've heard that song. I'm just, as an objective listener, I'm just like, wow, that's awesome. I like enjoying my own work like that.
You had a chorus of people helping you out there by the sound of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's me doubled in the background. And that was a karaoke track also that had the backing vocals on it.
It was a great track. I enjoyed it very much. Now, you know this podcast is going to be going out shortly before Christmas, and so I want to end with one of your Christmas songs. But as I said to you before we started recording, I'm not sure I can really pronounce it properly. What is it? Is Shubi Kalikimaka? Is that right?
Yes. Mele Kalikimaka is happy Merry Christmas in Hawaiian, but Shubi Kalikimaka is my version of it.
And can you explain what the Shubi is about?
Shubi is Shubi Taylor, whom I discovered through my bandmates from Fuzzy Love, and they were all into, you know, very crazy music, and one of the musicians that they liked was Shubi Taylor, and he had this just incredibly individual way of scatting, which was so absurd, and we all just loved it. So there's a scatting part of the song where I go into this sort of absurd scatting bit at the end, and that's in honor of Shubi, who has since left us.
I have to say, you're very good at that scatting, actually. The speed at which you go is absolutely incredible at the end.
Had to make it absurd.
Well, just before I play that, would you like to let people know then how they can get hold of your music? And I mean, you've got a number of websites, haven't you? Could you get the information out about that?
It's really all to be accessed through jjjones.de, which is Deutschland, which is where I set up the website when I was living in Berlin, and I do spend a lot of time in Munich now. So jjjones.de will pretty much connect to all of my projects.
And you have another website called I Am That Music. That's like a master page. Is it leading to two different places? Is that right?
I Am That Music is my record label in Germany. But it's because we've only distributed a Fuzzy Love CD, it's not really an active site. But it's still philosophically my record label, and I hope to release more things under that label in the future.
So jjjones.de is the main place to go.
Yes. And, well, look forward to a wonderful new single. I've collaborated with a group called Tosca out of Vienna, Austria, and I was just there performing with them for the release of their new album called Odeon, and I have a track on that album. They're a relatively successful sort of ambient club music band for the last 10 years, and I'm happy about that track, which, strangely enough, they decided to entitle JJ. It's some very spiritual lyrics in that song, and it's going to be officially released, I think, in January. But I'll put that link as well on my website.
Well, JJ Jones, it has been really enjoyable. It's been a very interesting conversation, so thanks a lot for sparing the time to speak with me today.
Likewise.
Now, all that remains, I'm going to play the music, but I just want to wish you, if I can do it properly, a Mele Kalikimaka. Is that right? Have we got that right?
That's perfect.
Excellent.
Although I'm not Hawaiian, so don't take my word for it, but it sounds right to me.
Shubi Kalikimaka is the thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day and all the stars at night. Shubi Kalikimaka is JJ's way to say Merry Christmas to you. I'm gonna get that shit up and do bop.